I'm Emily Kirsch, founder and CEO of Powerhouse and managing partner of Powerhouse Ventures. This is What It Takes, a show about the entrepreneurs making our climate positive future a reality. Before we get into the show, we have an exciting announcement. We're bringing back select live recordings of What It Takes, and our first and maybe only live recording of this year will be on Wednesday, April 24th at Powerhouse in Oakland during SF Climate Week. I'll be in conversation with Toby Kraus, co-founder and CEO of Lightship, which is building fully electric recreational vehicles. Tickets for the event are sold out, but we're hoping to host more live events in the coming months. Be the first to know when events are announced by subscribing to our newsletter at powerhouse.fund. That's powerhouse.fund. According to the World Economic Forum, if we want to reach a carbon-neutral future, the world will depend on emerging markets and developing economies to build energy systems that rely on clean energy instead of fossil fuels. An emerging market is defined as the economy of a developing region or nation that, as it grows, is becoming more intertwined or engaged with global markets. Think South Africa and Nigeria. In the US, our electrical grid is already built out and heavily reliant on fossil fuels. But in emerging markets, they have the opportunity to develop and integrate clean energy as they build out more and more capacity. Clean energy can help emerging markets improve energy security and reduce reliance on fossil fuels. But only one-fifth of global clean energy investments are being channeled into emerging markets. If there's so many compelling reasons to build these systems, why is there so little financing going into these markets? Financing the development of distributed renewable energy projects has been slow and challenging for interested investors and project developers. Investors may have little knowledge about this asset class, and there's rarely high-quality data about the performance of these assets after they launch, further hindering investors' willingness to allocate capital. Project developers in emerging markets are often smaller shops that haven't traditionally had access to international financing, they've struggled to procure the equipment they need, and they haven't had the ability to remotely monitor assets. So, in order to facilitate the growth of distributed renewable energy in emerging markets and connect financiers, equipment providers, and project developers who see the immense opportunity in decarbonizing growth in emerging markets, we need a platform where all stakeholders get what they need to finance, build, and track the performance of these projects. And that's exactly what this month's What It Takes guest, Emily McAteer, co-founder and CEO of Odyssey Energy Solutions, is building.
Odyssey's mission is to accelerate the flow of capital into distributed energy in emerging markets, ultimately scaling deployment of distributed renewables.
At Odyssey, Emily and her team are building a new kind of platform to make it possible for distributed renewable energy projects to launch in emerging markets by connecting financiers, equipment providers, and project developers, and providing the remote monitoring and control needed to assess performance.
Our goal is to make the financing process streamlined, standardized, and predictable. And we do that in two ways. We have software, we have technology that covers the full end-to-end life cycle of originating projects all the way to investing in them and operating them. And so we've got tech for streamlined, standardized due diligence, technology for procuring equipment once you have financing, and then we have a full remote management and control technology for really understanding what's happening with these distributed assets. The second piece of our business is a procurement platform that comes with finance, that we directly finance. So you're already engaging with us through our software, your EPC, your installer. We now have this network of companies that are all sort of coming to our platform, and we're leveraging that network to drive economies of scale in procurement.
Until Odyssey's platform began to bring financiers, equipment providers, and project developers together into one network, there weren't many solutions available for launching distributed renewable energy projects in emerging markets, despite their potential to bring reliable power to the 1 billion people worldwide living with intermittent access.
So think, a shopping mall in South Africa that's experiencing rolling blackouts saying, I want reliable power so that I can keep my lights on and my doors open. I'm going to go just put solar up on my roof and rely on that for reliable power. So that's sort of the opportunity in emerging markets that Odyssey's focused on.
Emily and her team recognized the gap between opportunities for growth in renewables and emerging markets and the financing available. So she and Odyssey stepped in to fill the gap and revolutionize the process of financing, building, and monitoring distributed renewables in emerging markets. Emily and her team are motivated by the opportunity to help emerging economies grow without the emissions and the negative externalities of fossil fuels.
From a big picture perspective, almost all greenhouse gas emissions growth is going to happen in emerging markets. And so it's absolutely essential that we all sort of play a role in helping emerging markets continue to pursue economic development, but do so in a low carbon way. And Odyssey is sort of focused on doing what we can through software and finance to make that happen.
In order to foster the growth of low carbon economic development through distributed renewable energy projects, Emily and her team have dedicated themselves to building a platform that works for all the players in emerging markets. I spoke to Emily about her journey from growing up in Concord, Massachusetts, to working on Wall Street, to the lecture that would change her life, to founding Odyssey and building a platform that's responsible for the deployment of roughly 2.5 million standalone solar systems and positively impacted the lives of 15 million people. Emily, you grew up in Concord, Massachusetts, and were a self-described very intense kid. Tell me about growing up in Concord, Mass, and tell me about young, intense Emily.
Yeah. I mean, the first thing you have to know about growing up in Concord, Mass is we are very proud of our role in the Revolutionary War. I grew up, first of all, always having this big competition with Lexington, Mass, because we both sort of claim that we had the shot heard around the world and grew up thinking that authors like Thoreau and Louisa May Alcott were the only authors out there. I mean, it was like, I probably have read Little Women five times. I was definitely an intense kid. Second grade, remember I couldn't get any project done, any of the sort of art projects or writing projects done on time because I just felt like they needed to be so above and beyond the assignment. When I was in high school, actually, it was my first sort of work related to Africa. I got very involved in, I met a former Sudanese slave and got very involved in the anti-modern day slavery movement and ended up drafting a resolution for the Massachusetts state legislature to condemn modern day slavery and held a big event at the State House. And learned, how to have the impact that I wanted to have. I was also a rower.
And you were in high school?
Yeah, I was in high school. That was my junior and senior year of high school. Yeah.
Wow. And then you said you were also a rower, which I was as well. So yes. I understand that part of the intensity.
Yeah, a lot of pushing yourself to the max.
So I know your family and community was very much focused on the environment. Your dad worked in the energy efficiency department of the local utility. Your mom worked at the Environmental Protection Agency. And then you told me that every summer you lived communally with a couple other families who were also environmental leaders. Tell me more about your parents, but then also these communal living summers and how they influenced you.
Yeah, maybe I'll start there. So every summer we would move into a house that we'd share with a few other families in the North Shore of Massachusetts, a fishing village called Annisquam, and would really, live communally, sort of had a very porous definition of family. It was like we had multiple parents and lots of siblings during that time. And interestingly, most of the parents all worked in some sort of environmental field. So my dad worked in energy efficiency at the state utility for decades. My mom was at the Environmental Protection Agency. One of the other dads, who we sort of refer to as uncles, even though we're not actually related, was head of Union of Concerned Scientists for many years. So grew up probably talking about climate change for sure a lot earlier than it was necessarily a dinner table topic in most households. Grew up talking about electricity grids a lot. My dad can talk your ear off about energy efficiency. So yeah, it's very much sort of been a part of me since day one.
I know in 2003 you went to Brown University and, no surprise, studied environmental science. What was it like studying environmental science at Brown at that time?
It's interesting to look back on it now because it was an interdisciplinary major, but not a ton of climate change focused. It was like environmental science in all forms. You know, we did a lot of studying environmental justice, water quality. I remember taking walking down to the river at the base of the hill in downtown Providence and taking water samples. That's changed a lot. I mean, I'm actually headed back to Brown next month and gonna, you know, check out their new climate change center. But yeah, it was a small program, just about a dozen of us in it. Small little house on campus was sort of the center of it.
Upon graduating from Brown, you spent 3 years on Wall Street learning how climate policy shapes investment portfolios at Risk Metrics. And then one day you attend a lecture on rural electrification in India that changed your life. Tell me about that lecture and what you did as a result.
Yeah, so the lecture was by Dr. Pachauri, who is the head of the IPCC, and it was about his work at the Energy and Resources Institute in India. He was talking about a campaign called Lighting a Billion Lives, focused on small-scale solar and efforts to bring light to rural communities in India that had been not connected to the grid and had no electrification. And it was just so exciting to me at the time because I'd been working on climate change for 3 years at Risk Metrics, thinking about U.S. climate policy, but realized that if I was truly going to understand the climate challenge, I needed to understand it from the emerging markets perspective as well. Like I talked about earlier.
Why did you have that thought? I feel like a lot of people just wouldn't have that as part of their framework. Do you know why you had that in a way that others didn't?
Yeah, because it clicked for me that if we're going to bring, you know, a billion people into modern day electricity use, we have to figure out how to do that in a low carbon way. We have to figure out how to do that with renewables. And we can't take the electrification path that we took in the US. And so it also just sort of clicked to me when I first heard Dr. Pachauri talking about this. And I said, you know, next up is going to go spend time in emerging markets and sort of understand the climate challenge from that perspective. And so I applied for a Fulbright and I moved to Delhi and had this incredible year sort of spending a lot of time in a lot of rural communities all across India, thinking about, you know, what's it going to take to distribute small-scale solar in these areas. You know, it was really interesting because back then it was solar lights and maybe small solar home systems. And the real question was, how do we socialize this concept with communities? How do we make them realize that these are reliable light sources over kerosene lamps? You know, now you can't go to a rural community in India and not see solar lights. So a lot has changed since then. But that was the beginning of a focus that I still do today. So certainly set me on a very, very clear path.
Mm. So you return from your Fulbright year in India and you complete a dual policy and MBA program at Harvard and Stanford. And upon graduation, like many of your peers, you were set to go into management consulting when former What It Takes guest Kathy Zoi, who's now CEO at EVgo, but at the time a Stanford professor, she pulls you into her office for another conversation that changes your life. What did Kathy say to you when she pulled you into her office?
Yeah. Well, okay. So first, maybe a little bit of context. I'd signed up to, I always, you know, even when I was in grad school, I was very passionate about working on clean energy and climate and focused on that in grad school. But I had this insecurity that I hadn't had a traditional sort of pre-MBA background. And I remember one of my, maybe my second or third week of school, I was in this group assignment and we needed to build a financial model. And I remember watching one of my classmates' hands like fly across the keyboard doing crazy Excel
shortcuts
stuff. And I was like, oh man, I'm behind. Like, I don't know Excel shortcuts. I've got to whip myself into shape. And so that's how I'd convinced myself I needed to go into management consulting. And so I was all signed up to do that and went to meet Kathy, who was an adjunct professor at the time, and expected to kind of have a conversation with her just generally about, you know, I was in a dual degree public policy and business program. She had crossed policy and business in her career. So I just sort of expect to have a generic conversation on that. And she said, as I walked in, this is so great you're here because I just accepted a position to become CEO of SunEdison Frontier Power. We're going to be building microgrids in India and East Africa. You should come with me. And it was just one of those total course correct pivot moments. I was like, yes, I'm doing that. And so I canceled my management consulting plan, joined her like pretty much the next day. And we started building microgrids in India and Africa. I've been doing that since pretty much.
I can see Kathy saying that and just being that definitive and just confident and like, obviously this is the thing for you to do, and love that you agreed with her. Tell me more about Frontier Power at SunEd. What were you doing there? What did that look like?
SunEdison was looking at the market and realizing that so much of the future of renewable energy development in emerging markets would be smaller scale and distributed. And so they were ready to make a bet on doing this, being the first really large scale renewable energy development company to do this. And SunEdison at the time was the largest renewable energy developer in the world. And so we were tasked with figuring out very quickly how do you scale a microgrid development business and start building thousands and thousands of microgrids in emerging markets from, you know, day one. So we flew to India, we flew to Dar es Salaam, we, you know, got in the weeds of figuring out all of the processes and systems that you needed to put in place to be able to standardize development of these projects. And then obviously the kind of financing piece was really crucial to that. So we were trying to figure out like, how do you raise and deploy large scale capital into, you know, many thousands of small assets that we were planning to build.
In April of 2016, after working on Frontier Power with Kathy for over a year, the mothership SunEdison goes bankrupt. Where did that leave you? And what did you do next?
Yeah, so it was pretty fascinating. I like to joke that I joined at the day of the highest market cap of SunEdison and left post Chapter 11, and it was all correlation, not causation. Yes, so the kind of plan to build Frontier Power ended with SunEdison ending, but Kathy and I had learned so much about the market, and we'd been thinking a lot about the technology that was going to be required for us to scale at SunEdison that we said, well, why don't we figure out how to build this for the rest of the market? How do we keep this going and sort of take everything we've learned and push forward the entire industry? And so we started thinking about what that could look like. And we originally actually had an idea of something even more than what Odyssey is today. It was a full kind of hardware business in a box solution, all the software you needed to build distributed renewables, plus the hardware, plus the finance. And we started kind of getting feedback on that. And we met Factory Ventures, who knew the market really well and had been thinking about something similar. And they said to us, okay, well, we've actually already invested in pieces of this already. There's already some plug and play hardware solutions out there for sort of these modular distributed energy systems. We've invested in some of them. We've invested in some of the metering solutions that you need. But what we really think is missing in the market is a finance platform. So like, let's focus on that. And so we said, great. And so we sort of joined forces with Factory. I moved to Colorado. That's what got me out here to Boulder to start working with them. And the first thing we did is we started just really socializing the concept with every single person that we knew in the market and said like, hey, what's it going to take to move capital faster? What does technology need to do? Is it possible to standardize the capital deployment process, and started getting early feedback. One of the first things we did is we hired a designer, a software designer, I think just through Craigslist or something. And he put together some mocks for us. And that was really helpful because we could actually put something in front of financiers and say, hey, this is how we're thinking about taking what is a very manual and bespoke process and turning it into a standardized software process. What do you think? And started to get really good feedback on what that would look like. once we felt like we were really onto something, we said with Factory, hey, let's you know, turn this into a real company and really start to build it. And so from there, we spun out Odyssey from within Factory and started building the company. And interestingly, built what we planned to build. Like it didn't pivot a lot for a long time. And still, I would say we've never had a massive pivot. It's always been sort of the evolution of the next thing. But I think that's because we knew the market so well and we had done so much early testing of, hey, do you think this is needed? That we were able to kind of start down the path and continue on that path.
So there have been two iterations of Odyssey. The first was a social enterprise that was primarily impact focused, with your operating capital coming from donors and development finance institutions or DFIs. And then the second and current iteration of Odyssey has raised venture capital. Tell me about the early days of version 1.0. What did you set out to build? How were you building it? And then who became your first customer?
Yeah. So in the early days, we were focused on mini grids or micro grids, so standalone solar systems in communities that didn't have access to power. And at the time, most of the capital that was supporting these projects was what we call concessional capital, development finance institutions and donors. And the first step we took was basically we built some wireframes and took it to all of those entities. We were partnered with the Shell Foundation, and they kind of convened a lot of other donors and DFIs in the space and showed them how we were thinking about standardizing and being able to use software to track every asset that was receiving capital, and kind of started to build out our product and our thinking in close collaboration with the industry and the folks that were kind of most active in the industry at that time. And our first customer was actually, pretty much our first customer was the World Bank.
It's a big first customer.
Yeah, I know. I mean, it was a total serendipity moment. I was presenting at some small event, and the head of a program, a World Bank program that was getting ready to launch in Nigeria, saw what we were building and just kind of like put it together of like, oh, this is exactly what I'm going to need for my program. I'm about to launch a $350 million financing facility in Nigeria, and I want to deploy every dollar and have it attached to actual results achieved. And those results are, you know, either a solar home system deployed or a mini grid built and a connection actually made to the customer. And so you can imagine like the challenge of trying to do that manually, track every single connection, prove that it actually happened and that there's no fraud and that connection is live and someone's using power. And he actually sort of put it together when he saw what our software was planning to do, that this is exactly what they needed. So our first customer was the government of Nigeria and the World Bank. And we worked sort of hand in hand to build this platform that that they needed in Nigeria, and that, you know, other countries that have since followed suit have all needed to smartly deploy capital into, you know, distributed assets.
Okay, so your first customer is the World Bank. Your first market was Nigeria. Take me to those early days in Nigeria. What was happening on the ground, and what was it like having Nigeria as your first market?
There's a joke in South Africa that if you've worked in Nigeria, you can work anywhere. I don't know why they just offer, like a lot of our partners in South Africa often say that when they hear that we started in Nigeria. Certainly not an easy market, but has been a leading market in terms of distributed energy. So the government passed distributed renewable energy policy that's been very favorable. Went through a ton of learnings through this World Bank program, but you know, all of the capital got deployed through those programs. It's now scaling up, and really sort of put us at the center of the market there. I mean, we because we're the platform that is used for all government subsidies. Pretty much any company that's doing any distributed renewables development in Nigeria has interacted with us. We've gotten to know them, and then that's what's helped us to kind of, I'm sure we'll get to this in a second, but get to Odyssey 2.0, which is sort of the next phase of software and technology and products that we can offer the market.
At the end of 2021, you decided to make the shift from the social enterprise 1.0 version of Odyssey to the VC-backed 2.0 version. What was your vision for Odyssey 2.0? And then who backed you in that vision as part of your $5.3 million seed round?
There were two things that happened that kind of led to Odyssey 2.0. The first was that the market itself evolved. Odyssey, we were early into the market. And as I mentioned, a lot of the capital in the market was donor and DFI money, which often is sort of the first money into a new market that then commercializes. So we were starting to see distributed renewables really taking off, becoming more commercial. The commercial industrial sector, C&I projects were, that market was growing in a lot of the countries where we worked in. And so that sort of gave us the confidence that, okay, this market has matured to the place where it's time to kind of think bigger. The second thing that happened is we, through the work that we'd done in the early days of Odyssey, we had developed such a network via our platform. There were many countries in Africa where, because we were sort of at the center of the market and at the center of big solar financing initiatives, we were engaged with so many of the different players in an otherwise very fragmented market. And we said, okay, I think it's time. The market's where we want it to be. The platform's where we want it to be. It's time to kind of take this to the next step and offer the next set of products beyond sort of our legacy donor DFI product. So that's where we were. And we had always sort of known that the operations piece of distributed renewable assets, so being able to monitor, collect really good data, and remotely manage and control assets was a big piece of this. And we were doing a little bit of it on our platform at the time, but decided we wanted to acquire a company called FernTech based in Germany, who had developed really great technology around this. And so we acquired FernTech, and that kind of completed the full cycle of technology on our platform. We had tools for everything from planning and originating projects through to now managing and operating them. And at that time brought in who I sort of consider my co-founder of Odyssey 2.0, Piyush Mathur, who's now our chief business officer and sort of my right hand, brought him in as well. So that really felt kind of like, I wouldn't say a rebirth, but the next phase of the company. And so then we set out to raise a seed round around this vision we had of taking the incredible foundation of technology and network that we'd created from Odyssey 1.0 and building technology and products on top of that. So we raised our seed round from Equal Ventures and had a really cool melding of the minds with Equal. They had developed a thesis around the need for end-to-end technology in renewables markets. So rather than sort of just point solutions, you know, just a solar planning tool or just a remote monitoring control, they use the term business in a box solution that covered all of the phases of project development. And that's what Odyssey was. They had written that thesis for the US market. So the only difference was that we had sort of built that business and that business model for emerging markets. But it was a really, really cool coming together and felt like a great fit. And so they led our seed round, which we closed in sort of middle of 2022.
Was it a hard conversation to have them see the opportunity in emerging markets, given that they had developed that thesis for the US, or did they get that pretty quickly?
Equal, not so much, because our investor partner there, Rick Zullo, had worked in emerging markets, in energy in emerging markets prior. So that was really unique as well. He sort of got it. But it definitely was a challenge generally in raising our seed round. Talking to US investors, they were still pretty nervous about emerging markets. It felt foreign. We sort of, that was a litmus test with a lot of investors. Like, we'd ask them right out, right, are you comfortable with emerging markets? And many of them said no. So that kind of closed a bunch of doors off the bat, which is always helpful when you're fundraising. Like, getting to the no faster is good. But yeah, we definitely had to find the set of investors that were comfortable with the markets that we were operating in.
Who else, in addition to Equal, shared your vision as part of the seed round?
We brought in 12 Below, a small fund in New York, Founder Collective, Abstract Ventures, and my climate journey.
Coming up, Emily and her team rethink Odyssey Energy Solutions and hit the ground running with Odyssey 2.0. But first, a word from our sponsors. What It Takes is brought to you by Microsoft. In January of 2020, Microsoft announced a $1.5 billion climate innovation fund alongside an ambitious set of sustainability goals. Since then, the fund has been investing in innovative technologies that have the potential for meaningful, measurable climate impact by 2030. To date, Microsoft has allocated more than $700 million into a global portfolio of over 50 investments, including sustainable solutions in energy, industrial, and natural systems. They strive to be an impact-driven investor, buyer, and go-to-market partner to advance solutions along the commercialization curve and make them affordable and scalable for others. Meet 12, the carbon transformation company. 12's revolutionary technology converts CO2 into essential materials and has the potential to address up to 10% of total global emissions. Alaska Airlines and Microsoft have jumped on board early as the first commercial customers for E-Jet Fuel, their sustainable aviation fuel made from air. You can learn more about 12's exciting progress at 12.co, that's T-W-E-L-V-E.co. And if you want to hear their founding story, we featured 12 co-founder and chief science officer Itasha Cave on What It Takes back in 2021. What It Takes is also brought to you by Shell Ventures. Are you ready to scale your work in the energy transition? With a dedicated $1.4 billion climate tech fund, Shell Ventures is partnering with innovative companies to build a lower carbon energy future. From renewable energy solutions to next-gen mobility and carbon abatement and removal, their portfolio of investments includes some of the most promising companies at the forefront of the energy transition. Portfolio companies like Mainspring, who we featured on What It Takes in 2022, who has redesigned the generator to seamlessly switch between clean fuels like biogas, hydrogen, and ammonia, providing clean energy generation and storage for EV charging, data centers, and renewable power. Portfolio companies like Kateri, who are working with regenerative ranchers across the United States to rotate their cattle more sustainably. Portfolio companies like Palmetto, who have built a clean energy marketplace, making it easier and more affordable for customers to decarbonize their home with rooftop solar and batteries. Shell Ventures is more than capital. They specialize in unlocking deployment opportunities both inside and outside of Shell to help their portfolio companies scale, access customers, and commercialize their solutions. Visit shell.com/ventures to learn more about how they can help your company reach the next level of growth. And now back to the show. You build Odyssey 2.0 to do three things. One, connect financiers and renewable energy companies for streamlined transactions, so providing the financing. Then you help renewable energy companies procure equipment. And then lastly, the remote monitoring and control via hardware and software to help companies and financiers track and manage asset performance. Who became your 2.0 customers? How did you get them? And then walk me through their experience on Odyssey's platform.
Yeah, so I think you did a good job summarizing it. The way we think about it is we have technology for financing your assets, for building them, which is procuring equipment, and then for remotely monitoring and controlling them. And depending on who you are in the market, you use our software in different ways. You might be, you know, our legacy customers like the World Bank using it for a subsidy program. You might be a local bank looking to scale solar financing for your customers, and you're using our technology for an end-to-end platform, everything from bringing customers in, sizing the system, connecting customers to EPCs to install the equipment, and then using our monitoring technology to ensure that the systems are operating well, and everything in between. You might be a project finance, you might be an infrastructure fund looking to do project finance, and using our technology to aggregate portfolios and deploy capital efficiently. So really, our goal with our technology is to provide the tools that are needed to do every stage of project development in a more efficient and data-driven way. We started with the finance piece, as we talked about. And when we sort of launched Odyssey, the next phase of Odyssey, we did a few things. The first is we expanded which type of financiers we were providing technology for. So we moved beyond development finance institutions to international banks, local banks, asset owners, IPPs, anyone that was sort of starting to think about scale and needing to use tech platforms to achieve that scale. The second thing we did is we said, hey, we've got this network of project developers on the platform. We want to work with equipment manufacturers and aggregate or sort of take advantage of our position in the market to aggregate orders, sign framework agreements with manufacturers and streamline the process of ordering equipment. And so that's the concept behind our digital marketplace for procurement. And we quickly realized that when we did that, we needed to offer financing ourselves for these orders because working capital is such a barrier to development in the market that we could solve. And so today that looks like a procurement platform that comes with short-term financing for equipment to get projects off the ground and solve that working capital challenge for project developers. And then the remote monitoring control piece kind of ties it all together. So no matter who you are and how you're financing assets, you want visibility into those assets. And so remote monitoring control is sort of embedded in all of our technology offerings.
Mm-hmm. Got it. And the business model for each, the financiers are just paying a license per seat kind of fee to be on the platform and to utilize it. The procurement, you're taking a cut of whatever is transacted on the platform. And then the monitoring and control, how do you all get paid for that? What's that structure?
Sometimes if it's just a customer using that, it's a SaaS fee or it's baked into one of our contracts for financing. And just a clarification, sometimes we do sort of license fees for our software. And then sometimes when we're really partnering with a financier, we actually have a transaction fee as well. So as volumes move through the platform and they're doing more solar financing using our technology, we take a piece of that and grow with them.
Since launching Odyssey in 2017, you've connected more than 2,600 renewable energy companies in emerging markets with about $1.6 billion of available capital. What are the key ingredients that have driven Odyssey's impact to date? And what keeps you motivated to stay in emerging markets, given some of the challenges that you've talked about?
Our team is sort of relentlessly mission-focused. Everyone joins Odyssey for the mission. We never lose sight of it. And we work very hard in what feels like uniquely difficult circumstances. I don't know. I mean, maybe all startups are this hard, but I've always worked in emerging markets, so I'm kind of used to how challenging these markets are. But I do think that that is how we've been able to achieve our impact, is sort of building a global team that's all unified around this mission. Our team is very distributed. We have, I think, about 18 to 20 nationalities represented on our team and folks in 15 countries. So I like to think we're the small but mighty, really, truly global army all sort of deployed to solve this challenge.
So you started Odyssey about 6 years ago. You've raised about $20 million, including a recent $15 million Series A that closed in 2023. You mentioned some of the investors who have backed you along the way, who joined as part of the A, and then what advice would you give to founders raising, especially those working in emerging markets?
Yeah, so for our A, we brought, it was led by Union Square Venture, so they joined, and then we had a couple new firms that we brought in as well. FJ Labs, who specializes in marketplaces, and then continued to work. Oh, Transition actually is a climate-focused fund out of the UK that joined our A as well. And then we continued to work with our existing investors. Gosh, advice for fundraising. I like to joke that I sort of have PTSD from fundraising. I mean, it is so hard, especially as many founders are. If you're very focused on achievement, and you've probably been sort of gotten to where you are by being achievement focused, it's a very uncomfortable position to be turned down a lot. And I know that this is a common topic. People always tell you that you get, 100 no's for the 5 yeses you get. But when you're in it, I mean, it's just very real. You have to really develop a thick skin. You have to believe that it's eventually going to work out, even when you have ups and downs and investors that are almost there and then do a 180. I mean, all of that stuff happens to every founder, but when it's you, you feel it very real, and it is really real. And, resilience is key. I had an investor, one of our seed investors reminded me when we were raising our A, that investing is like wandering in the desert, and you don't know if you're going to hit water. You hope so. And then when you do hit water, it's like you hit a water park. And that was definitely our experience. You know, it was like, we didn't know it was going to work out. And then we ended up having a, you know, hit water, had a competitive round, ended up with great partners, but, it's definitely a intense process.
You have about 50 people on your team today. What have you learned about hiring since starting Odyssey?
What's unique about hiring at Odyssey, and I mentioned this earlier, we have folks in 15 countries, almost 20 nationalities. I'm often hiring people who are very different from me. And, you know, in the early days, I think we all have a tendency to kind of want to bring on people that look like you, you know? And we don't do that at Odyssey. I mean, we need people in our markets with experience in our markets. And so they don't look like me. They have different contexts than I do. They probably think differently. And so I've really had to learn how to ask the right questions, run a hiring process that puts people in the right scenarios to really understand how they would do in our business and our environments. And I think it's something that we've gotten a lot better at.
Emily, if you could go back into time 6 years ago when you were founding Odyssey, what advice would you give yourself?
Two things. I would tell myself the importance of sort of articulating vision and strategy to the team over and over again. In the early days of Odyssey, I underappreciated how often people needed to hear the big picture. Everyone's sort of working on their piece of the big picture. They're not thinking about it constantly every day in the way I am. And so things were always sort of clear in my head. And I would get the feedback a lot that, hey, you need to tell us more about the strategy. And I'd feel like, oh, I just told you about it a month ago. And that's not often enough. I mean, even if it feels like you're repeating, you should be, because your strategy shouldn't be changing so frequently. It's important for people to hear it over and over again. And so that's something that I've, as a leader, learned to do and I'm still working on, frankly. I also would have probably built my leadership team earlier. My favorite part about my job now is my leadership team. I just had this incredible group of people, again, in so many different countries, Germany, South Africa, the US, India, Kenya. I mean, it's just, we come together from all over the place. And I feel like I've got people alongside who are each kind of like working on their piece of the puzzle. And that feels really good.
What did you think the hardest part of building Odyssey would be, and what has actually been the hardest part?
I'm not sure I necessarily even had thoughts about what was going to be hard. I sort of just blindly started down this path and started building this company. But what has been hard from the beginning and continues to be hard is just the sort of energy and resilience that comes from uncertainty. I mean, we're working on a really big challenge in hard markets, in a evolving market. And we can never just like relax and be like, we got it. We figured this out. You know, we've done a lot. We've achieved more than I even dreamed, I think, originally that we would achieve. But like, we have so much farther to go. We're like 0.001% of the way there, which is both exciting, but also tough, right? Because there's still uncertainty. We're still not like coasting in any way. And it just takes continued sort of renewal of commitment to what we're trying to build.
I ask every What It Takes guest some version of this question. You have three kids, all of whom you had during your time as founder and CEO of Odyssey. I know you were raising your Series A when you were in your first trimester with your third kid. What has it been like being who you are, a parent of three, a partner, a CEO, a white person working in climate tech and working in emerging markets? Like, what is it like being all of those things at the same time?
It's definitely a lot. As you mentioned, yeah, I've had all three of my kids during Odyssey's time. My husband is actually also a founder. So it's it constantly feels like chaos. But I also feel very blessed to have had certain things be a little bit easier maybe than the average person who's building a family. I mean, especially with COVID coming and working remotely, I, for example, often nurse my four-month-old on Zoom because, like, you can't see, you know. I work next door to my house, and so her nanny will bring her over, and I can nurse her, and I feel really grateful for those small things that kind of make this feel all possible. But yeah, I like to tell this story just because it's very real. Like, I was having my third kid. I found out I was pregnant right as we were launching our Series A. And so I was, you know, having 5 to 10 pitches a day for weeks on end and needing to show up and be on my game and then feeling really, really terrible. And like, I mean, having, you know, having to, in between meetings, you know, I'd be sick and then have to just kind of like snap out of it and go into the Zoom, the next Zoom pitch. And it was really, really hard. And you know, I got through it at the time, but I look back and I'm like, wow, that was something that, my male counterparts would never have to experience.
Last question before we move into our high voltage round. What will the future of renewable energy project development and financing in emerging markets look like in a decade? And if Odyssey succeeds, what does the company look like in a decade?
Billions and billions of dollars moving into distributed renewables as core energy infrastructure, and doing so in a systematic, repeatable, predictable way because we just really understand how to finance this type of energy asset.
All right. Our high voltage round, these are super quick questions, really quick answers, quick, like a couple of words. Emily McAteer, if you were an animal, what animal would you be and why?
I'm going to go with eagle. I've been told that I'm good at sort of maintaining that bird's eye high level view of things, but also have really sharp eyesight and never miss details.
What inspires you?
Well, maybe who inspires me? When I think about career, I often think about my father, who just had a, you know, an impact focused career and absolutely loved it for every single day. I've never met anyone happier with their job than my dad. And so I, often inspired to follow in his footsteps.
This question is going to be hard for you given your career to date. If you had to start a new career tomorrow, what would it be?
I know. I mean, I've been on the same path for so long, it's hard to imagine. But I think my next thing would be if my career to date has been very global and international, I think my next thing would be hyper-local. I've been thinking about how to keep making Boulder a climate hub and bringing more climate talent here.
Other than yourself, to whom do you attribute your success?
I have to go with Kathy Zoy, my original co-founder. And I mean, it's just someone who have learned so much from over the years, taught me so much about management, about career. I've watched her balance family and career. And she kind of put me on this path all those years ago when I walked into her office.
Tell me about a specific time that you've failed.
I think I've made a ton of small mistakes along the way. But no like major single failure.
What lesson has taken you the longest to learn?
There's no black and white, especially to company building and especially to success. You're never going to feel like I am a success, I did it, or I didn't. Everything is some shade of gray in between.
When are you your best self?
I'm my best self when I have a million and one things on my plate to get done and I am just executing and I'm telling other people how to execute and we're just like being hyper productive and moving forward.
What is your worst trait?
Self-criticism, holding myself to really, really, really high standards and sort of letting that paralyze me a bit.
If you could change one thing about the world, what would it be?
Carbon would be priced into all aspects of the market.
May we get there in our lifetime. If there was just one person who was going to hear this episode of What It Takes, who would you want it to be?
Maybe not one person, but back to my comment about sort of reiterating mission and strategy, I hope my team is listening hearing how proud I am of them and how committed I am to what we're trying to achieve together.
Finish these sentences for me. Companies fail because...
They either have the wrong product for the market or the right product, but too difficult a market, or they have the right product in the right market, but they don't execute.
If you really knew me, you would know.
You know I'm a huge Taylor Swift fan, and I have a young adult novel about her that's written in my head, and I'm on the hunt for a ghostwriter to write it and make it happen.
Oh, ghostwriter, get in contact. Also, maybe this is your alternative career.
Yeah, maybe.
Success is?
Making a huge impact with one's work.
If I could have done one thing differently, I would have...
I would have taken more engineering classes in college and not shied away from math and science.
If the world knew me for one thing, it would be?
I feel like it's obvious, but accelerating distributed renewables in emerging markets.
Very consistent. I'm most proud of?
I'm most proud of the team that we've built at Odyssey. The diversity of the team, commitment to mission, and how hard they all work towards that mission.
And last question, to build a successful startup, what it takes is?
Grit, resilience, dedication, and relentless focus on the mission.
Perfect way to end. Emily McAteer, thank you so much for joining me on What It Takes. I loved learning more about who you are, about Odyssey, about the impact you're making in the world, and I'm excited to just see that impact continue to grow.
Thanks for having me, Emily.
Emily McAteer is the co-founder and CEO of Odyssey Energy Solutions. Join us for new stories each month of founders who are building our climate-positive future, their upbringings, their risks, their failures, and their breakthroughs that are transforming our world. What It Takes is produced by Powerhouse and Powerhouse Ventures. Powerhouse is an innovation firm that works with leading corporations and investors to help them find, partner with, invest in, and acquire the most innovative startups in climate tech. Powerhouse Ventures backs entrepreneurs building the digital infrastructure for rapid decarbonization. Whether you're a first-time or long-time listener, you can support the show by giving us a rating on your podcast platform of choice or a review on Apple Podcasts. We read and appreciate every review, and we read some of them on the show. I'd like to thank What It Takes listener Valor Key for their review. They say, such interesting insights about so many important elements of what it takes to bring value to the world. And if you have a friend or colleague who you think might like this episode, please send them the link. I'm our executive editor. Isabel Lee is our researcher. Christopher McGovern is our producer. Jessica McAlin and Zandra Van Allebeek do everything else to make the show possible. I'm Emily Kirsch. This is What It Takes.